You know our slogan around here is better practice, better life. But we're taking this belief to the next level. And we've recently announced the creation of a new association. It's called the Best Practices Association. Our association celebrates the mindset that is better practice, better life. This mindset celebrates time, healthy living, personal growth, clinical excellence, and impacting the lives of your patients and your team through intentional leadership. In fact, we are the work-life balance experts in dentistry. The BPA will coach independent dental practices like yours to thrive by sharing best practices and operational habits, behaviors, systems, tools, and insight that lead to profitability and sustained growth, and you can still have a life. So if you're a dentist that wants to surround yourself with great thinkers, let us help you create your own version of better practice, better life. Go to actdental.com/BPA or hit the link in the show notes. Welcome back to the Best Practices Show, where we take a look at the best business practices from the best dental practices all over the world. My name is Kirk Barron, and I'm your host. We are just so excited to have you here to continuously learn. We're going to give you great tips, tools, techniques, thought processes to help you create a better practice and a better life. And today is no exception. You are going to absolutely love this. I got two incredible friends that are awesome thinkers. You will love this. So do us a favor, grab a pen and hit the share button, share this with your friends, because today we're going to be talking about treatment options when you don't really have any. So, and we'll tell you where that came from. Now, if you're here for the first time, I just want to welcome you and invite you to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, whether it be Google Play, Stitcher, iTunes, wherever, because we want you to get the most out of this. And you'll see every single week, we're going to be bringing you new thoughts from some of the greatest thought leaders in all of dentistry. Another thing is we take great show notes here. So keep visiting back to where you find these at, where you'll see the show notes for all the links, references, all the key opinion leaders mentioned, so that you can get the most out of this. And then lastly, keep sending us suggestions for shows, things that you guys want to see on a regular basis, because we want you to get the most out of this. And don't be afraid to share them with your friends. And today is a special edition, because in our partnership with the Seattle Study Club, we're going to be talking about a lot of great things, and most importantly, upcoming Seattle Study Club Symposium, which you do not want to miss. And that's going to be an awesome opportunity for you just to get incredible education. And we'll share some information about that here in just a little bit. But I want to welcome my two guests, two great friends, Dr. Kevin Groth and Dr. Robert Marjois, Bob Marjus. And we're going to be talking about treatment options when there are none. Now, I know, you know, some of the people that are watching this kind of know who you guys are, might know who you guys are. I always want to start, number one, with having everybody know who you guys are. And then let's talk about why this topic is so important. So who wants to go first?
Youth first.
Okay, why not? Well, my name is Kevin Groth, practicing restorative dentist in the Detroit area, and happy to be on here again with Kirk and Bob. It's been fun with the whole COVID conference, kind of get involved with this group of people that I've really learned a lot from when I first started watching this podcast, and now it's fun to be on. So it's an honor and privilege to be here, and have at it, Bob.
Thank you very much. I'm Bob Marjus, and I practice full-time in Des Moines, Iowa, and I've been practicing now for 34 years. It's been a great career. I've really enjoyed it immensely. I enjoy teaching. I enjoy still seeing patients, and I also enjoy kind of being the MacGyver when there is no options left for patients. So today's going to be very fun. Hopefully, you'll be able to pick up a few things that you can incorporate right away. And as Kirk had said, Seattle Study Club Symposium coming up is incredible. I've been fortunate to have attended probably the last 12, 13 years. And it's probably the best symposium in dentistry. So I really look forward to it. Even though it's virtual this year, it's going to be over 80 to 90 speakers. You'll be able to watch it from the comfort of your own home.
Yeah, absolutely. And so make sure you mark this on your calendar. But, you know, Bob, this is where you and I had originally met. Dr. Michael Cohen has done an incredible job of just putting together some of the best education you're going to find anywhere. And so if you've never been to a symposium, this is a great opportunity for you to get involved and just hear great thinkers. Some of the best education you'll see anywhere. And it's an awesome time. Just get energized. Now, we won't be able to hug each other and put each other in headlocks at the bar like we usually do, because it's all about relationships there. But if you're going to attend something that's virtual, it's going to make you think a little bit farther. This is definitely it. So we'll talk about that a little bit more, but make sure you mark your calendars for the symposium this year. Now, I do want to get into this topic because, Bob, you don't practice in New York City where people just walk in with a big roll of cash and everything is all pre-planned. And, you know, you've got treatment options that are pretty clear cut. Sometimes you got to go MacGyver. So let's talk about that, because you and Dr. Michael Cohen were talking about, you know, great thinking on this. And so where did this come up and why is this so important to a young dentist who's watching this?
Well, you know, there are times when somebody comes in that you think the only option really is an implant. Maybe they fractured a cusp off and you say they need to have an implant. Well, maybe they can't afford to have an implant. You can't assume everybody can afford to have everything they want, but if you can try to save that tooth, I by all means always try to save a natural tooth before going right to an implant, because that would be my last choice. And I'll tell you, I do like the line that Bill Strupp has always said. He goes, my job is not to save the patient's money, it's to save their teeth, which is a great saying, but there are times where finances can play an issue, and that I'm very sensitive to some of the needs of those patients.
Yeah. Now I'm going to challenge you too. And Kevin, you do some challenging here. We're going to talk about techniques. We're going to talk about options, but this really comes back to beliefs, don't you think? Like, there's a core set of beliefs that you have that guide your actions. And Kevin, I'd love for you to chime in that, but Bob, we're going to talk about that. Tell a little bit about the evolution of your beliefs. I love when you talk about your mentor. You know, you've had a lot of great mentors in your life that have helped you, you know, crystallize your own vision.
Yeah. You know, first off, man who says it cannot be done should not interrupt man doing it. And I do a lot of cases where I'll send photos to my buddy, Rob Ritter. And Ritter goes, you're not going to save that tooth. Oh, I know you're going to try to save the tooth. You just want to try to save everything. You know, my job isn't to save the patient money, it's to save their teeth. And I said, well, that is mine too. But let's talk about this patient. You know, the patient's 75 years old, fractured a lingual cusp, and it's fractured down by the bone. But the tooth structure, besides that one area, is good. So are you going to take the tooth out? Patient can't afford to have an implant. I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do is I'm going to build the tooth up, and I'm going to actually go down around that area. And am I going to be below the biologic width or impinging in that area? Yes, I am. Patient's 75 years old. And the likelihood of that patient having that tooth for another 10 years, even though it's not conventional, is high. And so that's where I look at it. Not necessarily just saving the patient money, but saving their teeth.
I love that. Kevin, piggyback on that, because you're a young dentist. What do you think when he says that?
Yeah, it reminds me, excuse me, so much of my father, who would always try and do what's best for the patient beyond just kind of the ideal. Sometimes you have to flex a little bit, you know, but he told me, once you kind of have an understanding of why that happened, then your restorative can really dictate a lot of the support that takes on. So yeah, you probably will put that cusp out of occlusion, Bob, but as long as you're comfortable with managing that 75-year-old very well could go the rest of his or her life with that restorative.
Yeah. Now another thing too. So I love this, and I've got a lot of experience with both of you. So I'm going to prompt you with questions that I already kind of know the answers for. But Bob, you don't ever tell anybody it's going to be perfect. You're always managing expectations. And then one of my favorite things you do is explain the new patient process, where you explain the three things and how you're the referee. Can we start there and then talk about the options? Because you're never going to tell anybody, oh, it's going to be perfect type of a thing. And you know, the article you always share when you're speaking is, you know, people get dressed up to go to Walmart in my town. So don't think for a second, you know, they're all really sweet people, but you know, they're just really good, you know, middle America people, right?
Yeah, they're hardworking people that don't say, here's $50,000, fix my teeth. If I get a couple of rehabs a year, I'm pretty damn happy. I get the ones that come in that say, I only want to fix my front teeth. I don't want to do the back. It's the only ones that I see. Well, there's a lot of times we can't just fix the front teeth because it's an occlusal issue. So when you said this, you do have to have your core beliefs. You have to draw a line in the sand. And I stole this line from my friend, Rob Ritter, but I've changed it with a few words so I can call it my own, saying this: just because you don't want to do the right thing doesn't mean I have to do the wrong thing. There comes a time where you have to really have your core beliefs on, you know, what you will do and what you won't do.
I love that story. He told me that on my show and it was so much fun, but he was bashing you a little bit saying you stole it.
They always have a credit issue where it originated from, right?
If Joe Biden can plagiarize and do that, I can take some stuff from Ritter and I can change a few words and call up my own.
There you go. Yeah, what a great story though. Him just tossing his gloves down and just walking out and saying that is just such a confident man who knows what's the best thing for the patient and walks out and doesn't really matter what it does after that.
Yeah. Now, go back and tell, like, I love your referee concept. Can you explain that? Because that, I think that plays into where we're going, because it's a very good position that you have with the patient and their conditions.
Yeah, the patient comes in and they may say, you know, this tooth hurts when I bite on it. And I may put a tooth sleuth on their tooth and they go, ow. And I'll say to them, Kevin, I'll say, you know, it appears to me that you have a cracked tooth. And normally what I would like to do is put a crown on that tooth to hold it together and hopefully you won't need anything else. But worst case scenario, that crack could go into the nerve through the pulpal floor. The tooth is split, non-restorable. Or the tooth could break, it could crack, and it could go into the nerve where we could do endodontic therapy and save the tooth with that and a crown. Or the best case scenario would be, I can put a crown on this tooth that you haven't been able to bite on and hold it together, that the only thing you're gonna need is a crown. And they look at me half the time and they're looking up and they're going, oh, it doesn't hurt me that much. It only hurts when I hit it with a taco chip. And that's when I say to them, you know what? It's your mouth, it's your time, and it's your money. I'm just a referee. I call it as I see it. It's your decision to have the treatment done if you want to do it.
Yeah. That's a perfect way of describing that situation, because everyone knows what a referee is, right? So that puts you in such a neutral zone that you're not, it's not on you, it's on them to make the call what they want to do. So I love that. I'm going to use that. I'm going to steal that and claim it in some fashion.
Totally.
Like other stuff.
Give us some perspective of what you see as a dentist. So, like, was that a freeing moment when you started discussing this with patients? I mean, do they get relaxed when you present that concept to them or what?
You know what? When I say that, it takes the pressure off, like I'm not trying to sell them something. It's not like I'm saying, if you don't do this, this is what's going to happen. I just give them the worst case scenario and say, listen, if it doesn't bother you that much and you can avoid it with a taco chip and it doesn't hurt, great. Just remember one thing. I don't work on the weekends. And if the tooth breaks on the weekend, the worst case scenario is you're going to be on your own at least until Monday or Tuesday. So you decide. I don't do a hard sell. I don't say, go talk to Shelly and set up an appointment and have a treat and have a, you know, the financial situation. Ultimately, they say to me, well, how much is it going to cost? I say, you know, a crown is approximately $1,200. Insurance is going to allow about $900. They're going to pay about 50% of $900. So it's going to cost you $450, give or take, plus maybe a buildup. So I do quote fees. I do say a problem so that the patient has an idea, but I never try to, you know, make them feel guilty if they don't want to do the treatment.
I think that's so profound, because so many people just say what the treatment needs are and scurry off into their office, hiding behind the door, waiting for them to say yes, for their office manager to come out and negotiate the fee with the patient. It doesn't come across confident, doesn't come across truthful, and it's almost like you're not a genuine person in that regard. So I totally agree. You know, be upfront with them about the costs. And I always say, I'm not sure what insurance is going to cover you, but this is what it usually is for.
Yeah.
You know, and then from there, you know, we can make this decision how you want to make it, depending on what is best for you. But also another thing about that, the less you say, the more confident it is and the more apt they're going to commit to it. Because so many young dentists get out and they talk and talk and they talk about the type of preparation and the margin that you're going to give them and the chamfer and the type of impression material, and the patient doesn't care, you know, and really that's what it comes to, is just the less you say, the easier it is to get people to say yes to what it is, because you have confidence behind it, what you're talking about.
Yeah. That's such a great point, Kevin. And it also goes, you know, I think there's another layer of complexity that some people might not know about you, Bob. You're a Delta provider too, you know, so like there's a complexity in there. You're a great speaker, an incredible clinician, and you're a normal guy with a normal practice. So you don't have this like elite level thing, which I really, really appreciate your candidness on this whole thing. I do want to get into the deeper aspects of the topic, which is like, give us some perspective. Like, how do I, if I'm a 32-year-old dentist watching this, you know, give me some scenarios when people come in and I have to do treatment when, you know, there's very few options or no options type of a thing. Like what?
I've had three cases this week. I can tell you right off of my head. Patient comes in with a partial, and one of the teeth on that partial is what holds the partial in on one side, and the patient's going to lose that abutment, and they really can't afford to have another partial made. And so what are you going to do for that patient? Ideally, I would love to make a new partial, but what I had to do was I had to put the partial in the patient's mouth, make an alginate impression, send it to the laboratory, and the laboratory will pour it up, and they will literally process a tooth around that clasp and then move another clasp onto an anterior tooth where I can still save that old partial by just adding a tooth to that partial. That just happened this week. Is it ideal? No. Was the patient thrilled? Yes. Absolutely. Versus a $3,000 partial for a $400 or $500 add tooth to partial.
That was mine last week. 93-year-old. You know, I'm not making him a new partial. There's no way. But same exact situation. It's a great, great move to be able to save them a whole new process with it.
And what you say, Kevin, as a young dentist, if I could have known this early on, when you say the less you speak, the better it is, because when you start talking and they sense that you're trying to sell them something because you want them to know how well you know everything and how to explain it, they're turned off by it. You are better off listening, saying this is what you need, because here's what happens. When you feel sorry for a patient and you say, okay, I'll just do this or I'll do that, and it's not the right thing, when you feel bad, bad stuff happens.
Oh, that's so true. I'm writing that down.
Yeah. Yes. So give us an example and give me, you know, the other examples you got this week on when there's no other treatment options.
Here is when I felt bad for a patient. Kevin, patient comes in that has six anterior teeth that have all the lingual worn off, all the enamels worn off, deep bite, and they have an existing partial. Okay. So they didn't want to have a new partial made. So what do? I say, well, you know what? I'm going to see if maybe I can prep these teeth and use the existing partial. And the teeth were already scooped out enough, a lot. So I prepped all the teeth for crowns. I made new crowns with metal linguals, saved the partial. And I'm thinking, wow, I did that patient a real favor. Well, you want to know something? 2 years after putting that patient's partial in and having those crowns, the teeth started breaking off at the gum. Mm. Why? Because I didn't open the bite and change the vertical. Sure. And all the pressure was still on the teeth. So did I save that patient money? No, I didn't. I cost the patient money. when in fact I was not doing the right thing for the patient. I should have said, listen, we've got to open your bite. We've got to do additive dentistry versus taking away dentistry, because now she's going to have implants or something different. It's going to cost her more money in the long run.
And even with the implant option, you're still going to have to open up her bite to restore the implants there. So you should have just done that from the beginning. I think that's a hard balance, though. It's an, you can't predict the future in dentistry, you know? So, you know, we never know what the right call is until after the fact, when it either works or doesn't work.
Yeah. So is it an experience issue, competence issue, or confidence issue? Like, give us some perspective. If you're a young dentist, why do we do that? You know, why do we get in predicaments like that where you feel bad? Is it a self-esteem issue? Just curious, you know, when you're younger.
I don't think you know what you don't know until you know, right? So I think you almost have to go through those moments of failure. And then the next time you can identify that I should have opened up that bite a little bit here. Or it's also really great to have mentors that can guide you along and talk through this. Because if you have somebody that you can show or talk through a case, or an associate, senior doctor type of relationship that can say, hey, been there, don't go down that road because this is what's going to happen. That really makes a huge difference in terms of, instead of going through the steps, you can skip a couple steps there. But there's nothing better than a lesson that you have to have a hard thing to swallow, because it's just, things are going to happen and you learn the best from those failures and openly admit that, that that's just the only way to grow, I think. I don't know if you agree, Bob, but I'm sure you've had plenty of failures.
Well, you know what happens, Kevin? When you're young and you're out of school, you want everybody to like you. You don't want to have to tell the patient maybe necessarily what they need, because here's what happens. I come into the operatory and the patient says, you're not going to find anything, are you? And you know what I say to them? If I find something, do you want me to tell you? Or should I just not tell you and say everything is good? I put it back into their own, you know, because you have patients that say, you're not going to find anything, or the ones that say, I don't want to have any x-rays. And they haven't had x-rays for 2 or 3 or 4 years. And you know, you can't tell what's underneath the crown, or you can't tell without taking the x-rays. And so I say to the patient, you know, I want to limit the amount of radiation, but I can't give you an honest assessment of your teeth without having x-rays once in a while. You agree?
Oh yeah, no doubt about that. However, you can have those conversations once you've known the patient for 2, 3, 4 years. You know, it's really hard to walk in the first time as a brand new dentist and try and win people over and tell them the hard thing that they need to hear. So that's also a balancing act that you kind of have to juggle, but that's what we get ourselves into. But
Now talk about the inherent challenges that, because I know you guys both well enough, you like predictability. You like treatment planning. You like thinking didactically through a case. And then when you're like, I mean, it's a little bit hard. Like I've heard, I won't mention names, but like one of you said, don't touch my stuff. Like you like your stuff the way it is, you know, we're a little OCD. And so when it comes to making these decisions, they're hard, right?
They are hard. And sometimes when you talk about, Kevin was fortunate. He had a father that was a dentist. So he could see some of the things that his father did that maybe he would have never seen in dental school. And they say, oh, well, we don't do that in dental school. But I was also fortunate to have a mentor that was doing incredible things that I learned about. And one of them is the use of pins and amalgam pins. And I have, if I opened up my phone and showed you texts from my good friend, Rob Ritter, giving me crap because I'm taking pictures along with my iPhone of what I'm doing. He goes, oh my God, you're going to put a pin in there. Yeah, you're going to build it up and you're going to grab two structured and pins on the biologic width. I said, yes. And I'm going to show you a 10-year post-op. So is it ideal? No, it's not ideal. But if you've seen somebody, you've had a mentor who has done it and you've seen the track record of that, I can say to you, Kirk, are you a gambler? Are you willing to take a gamble? Because I'm here to tell you this. If I put this crown on here and it doesn't last a minimum of 5 years, I'm going to credit you what you paid towards something else. I'm going to accept some of the responsibility. After 5 years, you're on your own. And if they don't want to take that chance, I'm not going to do it. But I'm going to try my best. Have I been burnt? Absolutely. But I've been on the winning side a heck of a lot more than I've been on the losing side.
And I'm sure Kevin, some with that.
Right? Kevin, I guarantee you've seen cases your father did that are years old that you're like, oh my God, I can't believe that worked.
Sure. The only dispute I would have would be there was one patient that he did something crazy on and it lasted for about 20 years. And then I inherited him at 92. And he thinks I can put some type of MacGyvering. But he didn't have a single bit of tooth to work with. But he goes, no, this is in your blood, man. You got this. You got. I'm like, there's not a single dentist in the country or the world that can restore what you have. You need a denture, man. But otherwise, no, it's been fun to see the things that he was able to do and the things that have lasted. And ultimately, when you do treat people like family or you treat them with the respect like family, you're going to try and do what's best for them. And patients rave about the things that he went and tried to do to save what he could to make what he felt was right happen. So I think that's an important thing is if you just treat people honestly and know that this is what's and but also, like you said, Bob, talk to the patient as if it's, this is probably something that could fail. So now it's not just right on your end of things that, oh, he messed it up. He told me about it. You know, he knew that this was going to be something that could break. Or there could be sensitivity here, or who knows what could happen. But if you lay it all out there prior, it's not a mistake. It's, he told me so.
Yeah.
Important thing too.
Let me ask both of you this. Like, do either of you run into a situation where you don't know where to go at all? Like, or you're just like, I'm kind of stuck in this one. Or do you have a few simple rules that help you through those uncertain situations?
I mean, you probably know everything, right, Bob? You've been
absolutely. When I don't know what to do, I say, let me make some alginates. And then I'll make an alginate and I'll put it on my desk. And then when my buddies come over, I'll pull the models on and go, what do you think? What would you do in this case? Otherwise, what I do is when my prosthodontist gets a referral from me, he knows it's a bad case.
You're not sending them the really good stuff. You're sending them the, yeah, whoa, exactly. I don't know where to go here.
That's good. But I mean, the nice thing with the alginate, it gives you a pause, right? So you don't have to do something right away. It gives you a little bit moment of reflection and you can step back. And same with taking pictures. You can just say, okay, let me just look at this a little bit more closely. So it gives you a little bit of time to think about things.
That's what I say. When I don't know what to do, my first line is, let me make some alginates.
Exactly, right? So tell me more about your MacGyvering. I want to know more about this.
Yeah, let me tell you. Another example would be, and I'm 100% successful, 100%, not 90, not 99. A patient comes in that has an old bridge and they fractured porcelain. Let's say they fractured porcelain off and the metal is not exposed. And if I can just lightly prep that, prep a little margin and get an impression, I have been 100% successful bonding a porcelain veneer to a porcelain bridge with silane and resin cement that the veneer has never come off. It may have chipped before, but to debond, bonding ceramic to ceramic, if you can etch it. Now, I'm not saying to zirconia, I'm saying to etchable glass. I will definitely repair a bridge by bonding a veneer to, let's say, a 6-unit bridge and save that patient a lot of money. Or if it's a porcelain fused to metal bridge, I literally will prep it like a taco shell like this. It'll be a metal core with porcelain on the outside. And I will literally bond that to the bridge and have many, many, many years of success. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just a couple examples. And I've got other ones, but I'd like to hear what you even have to say. Have you repaired bridges? Have you used any type of ceramic to bond a ceramic yourself?
I'm thinking about a current situation of a patient I saw today that's similar to what you're talking about. Is she has an old bridge, but it has like endo like crazy and some silver points. And I'm just like, I'm not touching that thing. I don't want to mess with it. But she also has some recession there. And I've tried to do some fillings around the recession to mask it, but it's not working out well. So can you do that little prep through the porcelain, but then also kind of prep on the,
oh,
on the recession area too and do a little bit of a...
Absolutely. If you have somebody who actually had a porcelain fused metal bridge and the porcelain came all the way off and only the metal's exposed, you'd literally prep a chamfer on the lingual, mm-hmm. a chamfer on the facial. You have the laboratory make you a taco shell metal with porcelain on the outside, and you bond that with Panavia. It's not coming off.
That's great.
As long as you have clearance, you got to have lingual clearance so they're not banging on it. It's not going to come off. You're going to have really good success with that.
Now, are you doing porcelain etch and then bonding agent and Panavia? That's your process, or is there something I'm missing there?
Yeah, what I'll do is this. I would sandblast the metal. Mm-hmm. I would sandblast the inside of my Pontic fake tooth. And then I would use metal primer and then just Panavia cement and bond that on. Kevin, it's not coming off.
That's great.
Yeah, it's not coming off. The other thing was this. When patients come in that have a vertical problem, but they can't afford to have all the crowns done at once, I literally will bond to gold. I will bond to ceramic with composite. And the way I do it is, if I'm bonding to gold, I will sandblast the gold. I will either use an inverted cone burr if I want it a lot. And I will invert a cone and I'll put little retention in the gold. I'll use like a metal primer, like a Z prime or Panavia primer. Mm-hmm. And I will bond composite to that gold. That'll stay on for 2 or 3 years so that they could have the anterior teeth done this year.
Perfect.
And then they do the posterior teeth over time, 3 or 4 years.
That's great. That's a great way to segment it, both from your energy perspective, the financials of the patient, you know, the stability overall, that you're not having to tear it all up. And I mean, I love that. That's a great thing. I'm going to definitely utilize that. And now, one thing about you, Bob, is that you're so in tune with the materials and you have such a good knowledge of this. And that, to me, as a young dentist, I didn't get a lot of exposure to that in dental school. And quite honestly, that's my crutch, that I know what I know, but I'm not comfortable going outside that realm. Is there any suggestion you'd say to young dentists that you'd say, this is a good resource in order to learn what's best for these situations?
Let me tell you what, you're not alone. 100% you're not alone. My associate's been out of school for 1.5 years and he still comes to me and says, now, how do I bond that on? What are the steps? Do I put the primer on the tooth? Do I put it on the metal? Do I have to sandblast it? With the zirconia, do I etch the zirconia? Do I have to put hydrofluoric acid? And that really comes with experience. And you know, at ACT Dental and with the COVID webinars, we heard everybody from Jerry Sheesh, from Suleiman. You know, we heard Nate Lawson. They taught us. And let me tell you what, even practicing 34 years, I still have to remember, because materials change. You got to remember, okay, do I have to prime that? Do I have to put this, do I do this on the tooth? And you almost have to have cheat sheets in order to really be good at remembering what to do.
I think that's great advice. And I think it makes me feel better. And I also think it's nice that your associate has some confidence that he can go to you with vulnerability too. Because I think in dentistry, we're so perfectionistic driven and we can't admit that we don't know something, because I think that's how we're wired in dental school, that we have to know everything all the time and be perfect. So I think if you have a mentor or some person that you can go to for these suggestions, I think, I don't know, next time I'm going to have a materials question, I'm going to give you a call, because I think this is just, it's incredibly helpful to have someone in your corner to guide you along. And that's something I think a lot of people don't necessarily have.
Yeah. So here's what we're going to do, Kevin. You're going to take a photo of all the most difficult stuff you get in the next 3 months. And we're going to have Bob back.
Perfect.
And he's going to walk us through what to do.
But that's regular dentistry. That's what awesome. We encounter. You know, like you said, it's not like we're in New York where people are rolling up here with a wad of cash and they're just saying, just redo my whole mouth. You know, I don't practice that way either, but it is encouraging when you see someone like Bob or someone like Bill who come out and say that 90% of their practice, 95% of their practice is just bread and butter dentistry, you know, but that's really, I don't know, that's encouraging to everybody that we can get those cases every now and then, but there's also ways around it that you can really MacGyver and make it right for the patient to get a last I don't know. I'd say it's success if you give it 5 years for a 75-year-old or 10 years or whatever.
Let me tell you, I get a kick out of the patient that comes in. And I want to give you a couple examples here as a young dentist and even as an old dentist, when I get a new patient from a dentist who retired and the patient had been going there for 20 years, okay? This is a scenario. They come into hygiene. They've got some large amalgams. They've got recurrent decay, and they've got issues that need attention. This is my line to those patients. I say, Kevin, you have been going to Dr. Smith for all those years, and he's done a great job, and he saved your teeth, but there are some areas that need attention. And you may not trust me or know me because this is your first appointment. And some of the things I'm going to tell you are not going to be something that you may want to hear. I say, because you've got 3 or 4 teeth that need attention at a cost of around $5,000. But what I want you to do is this. I'm going to give you a set of x-rays. I'm going to send these x-rays to any dentist that you want if you would like or choose to have a second opinion. I'm confident enough to know that this can be overwhelming to you because you don't know Dr. Margis. And so I want you to know, feel free to have a second or third opinion because this can be overwhelming to you.
I think that's a great thing. Cause yeah, I mean, you can stand behind your now decision with them and say, I believe in what I'm doing is what's best for you. I'm not trying to sell you on anything. You know, now you have to go to someone else and get a second opinion and judge what you're coming up with. But I love that. I'm thinking that's a great piece of advice.
While the words were beautiful, what I heard was I'll hold out and do the right thing for the patient. You know, the patients need the dentistry more than I do as a clinician. Do you know what I mean? So, and you're confident enough to know, look, I don't need every patient and every crown in your office. So this is,
if you tell the truth as a young dentist, just tell them the truth and shut up. And if they want it, but here's the problem. If you tell a patient, and I told Nick this, my associate, you tell a patient that they need all this work and it's incipiencies and they really don't need it, and they leave our office and they want a second opinion. And I say this, I am not offended. Some dentists are offended when somebody wants a second opinion. I'm not offended. Why? Because I'm telling the truth. The dentists who are offended are the ones that may have something to hide.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No doubt. Also, you're going to lose patients in your career, right? I mean, it's just going to happen. Patients, things are not going to work out, or someone's going to do something and leave in some matter. Once you lose enough of them, you know, and I can think of 4 or 5 in my head right now, you kind of stop caring about trying to lose people and try and just win everyone over. You know, right. And that makes a huge difference is you're not bending over for people. You're just treating people how you want to be treated and you would do what's right for them. And stop trying to worry about people walking out the door because they're going to do it. It's going to happen no matter what you do.
So. My former boss, my mentor said to me, yeah, Marcus, you think you're really good. You lecture, you publish this and that. He says, come on downstairs. Let me show you something. He takes me downstairs to a filing cabinet with hundreds, if not thousands of files. He says, you see these dead files here, these dead files? I go, yeah. He goes, do you think all those patients are dead? They're not dead. They left your practice because they don't like something about you or something you said. If you think you're that good, you better get another thing because not all those patients are dead. He says, one thing about it is this. I don't want to hear anybody say, they may say you're single and you go out and you date and you drink and you do, but I never want to hear anybody say he's a terrible dentist and he's a liar and he's a thief.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. It's powerful.
I love that.
It's powerful.
That's great. You have any more tips? Yeah. Anything else that you come up with?
Hey, yeah, I can. And the other thing he said is never alienate other dentists in your town.
Sure.
Never alien. Always be somebody who is a helper. He says, because he, and then he takes me outside and says, look at all these buildings. Look at all these people walking around. Do you think all those patients come to you? They don't all come to you. They come to you for one reason or another. He goes, you tell other dentists if they have issues or if they want to learn how to do veneers, I'm here to help you. Because there's going to be a time that a veneer case comes into them and they don't feel comfortable doing it. And they're going to send it to you to do it. But if you help them do the easy ones, you're going to get the hard ones.
That's a great point. Great point. Awesome. Well, Bob, I know we don't get you for a long time, and we're going to have a bunch of these conversations in this great series. So I always like to leave everybody with a good word. So Kevin, Bob, who wants to go first? Leave us with a good word on this topic.
I think MacGyvering, like we talked about, is just doing what's appropriate for the patient, you know, and not just looking from like a technical clinical element of things, but what is best for them from an age or financial or health or whatever it may be. And if you can try and save a tooth, like my friend Bob Margis has now said in rendition to Bill Strub, save a tooth as much as you can. You know, I think that's important and try and do what you can, but you also have to have the tools and the skill set in order to be able to manufacture something that can last too. So I think that's important. But that's my takeaway from this. I love that. That's been, I mean, amongst many things we talked about today. So thank you for that, Bob.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, Kevin, I'm really proud of you and what you've done during COVID, because I didn't know you at all, except I came to your study club, this and that. But I mean, your career is going to be like skyrocketing because you've had the ability to listen to people before you and learn from their mistakes. And you don't have to reinvent the wheel. I would say my takeaway for anybody listening, young, old, practicing 30 years, tell the truth. All you have to do is always be honest and don't try to, you know, utilize patients for financial gain. I think if you always explain the procedure, always explain ideal treatment, but know that maybe you can't do all the ideal treatment right away. At least you've built that into, their mindset. And one other thing, I've said to patients that come in with a large amalgam and you can see the gray shine through of that tooth. And I would say to them, you know, Kevin, that tooth has a large amalgam. There's a good possibility that it could break. My recommendation would be to put a crown on it. That'd be the right thing. They come in 5, 10, 15 years later, and that amalgam is still in there. They say to me, I remember when you told me you should put a crown on this. I never have had a crown yet.
That's awesome.
Awesome.
It happens. Awesome. It really does. I still have patients saying your dad told me 30 years ago I needed something here. You know, it's like, yeah. Well, 31 now, I guess. I don't know.
gosh, I love this. I want you guys, like, we could go for 2 or 3 more hours, and actually we will on separate episodes. But this is, I'll leave with this last one. And Pete Dawson said this to me at the age of 24. I tell this all the time. I asked him at the end of the how to put your practice in the top 10%. I said, Dr. Dawson, I did not want to be here today, but I'm so happy I was. And I said, what's the one thing you could tell me being young in this profession? He said, that's a good question. He said, I would tell myself, don't ever say you have it all figured out. Stay around people, keep learning, because the people that have it all figured out, they're not that much fun. And he said, even at my age, I'm still learning. So like, I just enjoy this stuff so much. So if you're a young dentist, 32, and you just found your way here, just keep joining us, keep learning. These guys are awesome. And the thing I love about you guys, among many things, is just that you're so willing to share what you're learning and passing it along to the next generation of dentists. So it's just a lot of fun. And, you know, which leads us to what we talked about at the beginning, which is where I met you, Bob, at the first thing is, which I'm just going to highly encourage you in our partnership series with the Seattle Study Club Symposium. If you guys have never been, or even if you have been, on January 19th through the 21st, this year, symposium will be virtual and they have an incredible lineup. So Bob, you want to just talk about that for a second? Tell us, like, what is it? If somebody's like, what is Seattle Study Club? Give us your 2 cents on that.
Yeah, you know, I leave Seattle Study Club. People think, oh, you're going to Orlando because it's a dental meeting, but you're going to be sitting on the beach. Nah, this isn't Seattle Study Club. Seattle Study Club is you're in the meeting learning not only dental tips, but everyday tips, health tips, dental tips, practice management tips, finance tips. and you're learning from the best in the world. And I will tell you this, you're going to be able to watch either live, and I know you're going to have about 30 days after the symposium to come back and rewatch what maybe you have missed. And when I'm looking at these speakers here on this slide, you're not going to get it anywhere else. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's unbelievable. So I would definitely recommend attending this symposium. And this year, even if you're not a Seattle Study Club member, let's say you're in an area that doesn't have a Seattle Study Club, you're still invited to attend this year's symposium virtually.
That's great to know. I'm looking at that list and I'm seeing all these speakers and I'm just like, I'm totally committing to that. I mean, that sounds like such a great lineup of people. And a lot of people we had on the COVID conference, you know, and it's just something to just reunite everybody and learn from. And I'm totally jumping on board with that right now. So, I mean, do yourself a favor if you're a young dentist, get on that, because there's so much to learn and so much to pick up in those, was it 3 days, 19th through 21st?
Yeah.
In 3 days.
No brainer. Check it out. Not only great clinical education, great life education. I mean, I've heard from some of the best psychologists, you know, trainers, just everything, authors, just it's awesome stuff. So I highly encourage it. So if you, you know, stick around while you guys, while we say goodbye to everybody else, but if you're watching today or listening today and you enjoyed today, just do us a favor, hit the share button, share it with your friends. Like I said before, keep sending us suggestions for things that you guys want to see. I'm going to have Kevin and Bob back for more and more of the difficult questions. I know you guys want to know answers to. I have a lot of them and I'll save them for our next show. But thank you guys for watching today and listening today. Until we see you next time, keep watching the Best Practices Show. You guys enjoy the rest of your day.